Chapter 13, Dilly's Special Book. "I have something to say," whispered Dodd to his friends as they sat in the dark. "But you can't tell anyone. Can you keep a secret?" In the murky dimness, Dodd could see well enough to notice four nodding blobs. "Like I was saying before, Pap's house is built on the roof. You have to climb up through an old quick rappel to get to it. Pap's been living there for his safety, ever since his encounter with the Dread. Bamboo told me practically no one knows of it."
"Whoa, that sounds neat," muttered Buck excitedly.
"And you're being serious?" asked Dilly.
"I'm totally serious. I'll take you there when it's safe. I went back to it alone after Bamboo showed it to me. I wanted to skim through some things my grandpa wrote, but they were all stolen, and someone was still there in the darkness. He chased after me. I barely escaped with my life."
"So the men on Flutters were raiding Pap's house," said Sonny.
"I think so," answered Dodd. "It would be a pretty logical way to get in, since I have the only key to the front entrance. Even Bamboo doesn't have one."
Dodd patted his lower neck and felt his heart begin to pound in panic.
"My keys! Where are my keys? I had them right here."
"All three of your keys from Pap?" asked Dilly apprehensively.
"Yes, I kept them on a chain, and now they're missing."
Dilly searched her pockets and produced two brightly glowing stones.
"We need to find those keys. Are you sure you don't still have them?"
Dodd felt his neck and searched his clothing. When he came up empty, Dilly moved in. She appeared more concerned about the keys than Buck and Boot.
"I must have lost them during my escape," groaned Dodd painfully, feeling the tug of a sinking pit in his stomach. He couldn't believe that he had already failed to keep them safe.
"Oh, great," grumbled Dilly sarcastically as she leaned over, inspecting him. "It appears they were torn from you." She ran her finger across a fresh, thin scab. Dodd felt the ring of dried blood. It circled halfway around his neck, ending near his ears.
"You must have known when they were taking your keys," insisted Dilly, perturbed. "Someone pulled your chain until it broke. Couldn't you have protected them? You had Pap's sword."
"I was in a hurry, trying to escape with my life," complained Dodd miserably. "It was pitch black. Everything happened so fast."
Dodd was surprised that Dilly seemed even more bothered by the loss than he was, and she didn't appear the slightest bit troubled by him having been assaulted.
He retraced his steps in his mind, mumbling audibly. "I ran down the hall and out the door, searched for a harness, repelled the wall, and then was attacked."
Dodd's voice trailed off. The choking had taken place as he arose from the floor of the shaft. In retrospect, it was hard to remember what had strangled him. Possibly it was just his chain, stuck to something. And furthermore, the enemy hadn't fought back when he wielded his sword.
"I think I know where the keys are," admitted Dodd, feeling stupid. "At least I hope I do. Unless the Dread followed me down and found that I left them."
"You ran from the Dread?" squeaked Sonny. The soft light illuminated the distressed look on her pale face.
"Yes, I'm pretty sure it was the Dread. Who else would have been smart enough to figure out where Pap's hideout was and capable enough to get inside? He was determined to steal Pap's records, along with another collection Bamboo spoke of."
"All that intrigue over a couple of notes," said Buck, giving a doubtful look. "Even Sonny doesn't like books that much."
"They were more than a couple of notes," insisted Dodd. He leaned in closer to Dilly's rocks until his face was clearly visible and explained vigorously. "Bamboo said they were volumes which contained details from top secret missions. If the Dread stole them, he will be able to gain key information, the kind of facts he could use to destroy kingdoms. Think about it. That's how he works, right? The Dread plays everyone like a game for his own purposes. Those diaries could be worse in his hands than nuclear weapons."
"What kind of weapons?" asked Boot, chuckling. He wasn't very worried.
"It doesn't matter," rumbled Dilly, taking charge. "Dodd, you said you think they are at the bottom of a quick rappel. So where is it? Let's go." Dilly grabbed Dodd's shoulder and rose to her feet, determined to get the keys back.
"Whoa, Twisty," said Boot, hopping up beside her.
"We can't be going anywhere tonight. Jib's sitting outside polishing his shiny little security badge, waiting to haul us off if we so much as crack the doors open."
"Anyway," Boot continued awkwardly, searching for the words to dissuade Dilly, "what's the big deal? If we can't find the keys, or even if they have been stolen, we can ask Bamboo for assistance. I'm sure it wouldn't take long to replace the locks."
"You're missing the point," wailed Dilly, growing unusually anxious. "The issue is trust. We don't want to go to Bamboo and tell him we've lost the keys and need help getting into Pap's place. Besides, you don't know what the two small keys go to, so how could you replace them?"
"Well, Twisty," said Boot playfully, grabbing her by the arm, "if we don't know what they go to, How would we be able to use them anyway? And if we find we're locked out of something, I can always bust it open for you.
Boot posed in a manly way, flashing his fun-loving eyes.
Ah, boys, spouted Dilly in agony. You always think you're so smart. Trust me, we need to get Dodd's keys back, and fast. They may be more important than you think, Booty. And stop calling me Twisty. You know even my mom hasn't called me that for years. My hair is now more of an elegant, curly wavy.
Dilly reached into the lowest pocket of her pants and produced a red leather-bound notebook and a small black stick. She flipped past many pages until she came to one that was near the middle, and then she wrote, "Obtain keys from hidden shaft."
Dodd looked over her shoulder and began to read the list that accompanied the most recent entry.
"Do you really expect to do all of that?" he asked, shocked by her aggressive to-do list.
"How do you propose personally counting the number of soldiers? Wouldn't it be easier to ask someone like Jib?"
"You said it yourself. You can't be trusted," said Dilly curtly.
Boot and Buck quickly joined Dodd in glancing down her agenda. They knew Dilly took her slates very seriously. If it was written, it had to be done.
"I can do that one and that one," said Boot, pointing at two of Dilly's entries. "Casually interrogate Strack concerning Bly's recent whereabouts and coerce Saab into an unofficial, full-out round of Belurs, triple team, Green against Rawl, while Dilly and Sonny search Rawl Hall unnoticed."
"And I think Buck and Dodd can help me do that one," said Boot. Below his finger was written, "Break into Zerny's quarters while he's out."
"But there's no way, and I mean absolutely no way, you are going to get me to do that one."
Boot pointed firmly where Dilly had scribbled, "Have Boot apologize to Jib for not choosing him as a Kusing."
"It's not what you think," remarked Dilly. "Doesn't matter. No chance there."
"I just wrote that down to remind me of the whole task. You jolt Jib as a friend for some facts on the current situation. He once looked to you for orders. Maybe he'll bend and say something."
"I doubt it. What do you think, Dodd?"
Boot looked at Dodd, who was more than fully aware of the not-so-warm feelings between the two, having just seen Jib and Boot squabble in the hall. Dodd shook his head. "That one's hopeless."
"Besides," added Boot, looking back at Dilly, "after what Jib said to Bowie, I don't care what I could get from him. It's not worth it."
"Think of it as you will," said Dilly, changing gears. She got a glint in her eye that sparkled with glee at the challenge of convincing Boot into doing her bidding. "Just pretend to be his dearest friend," she continued. "Forget what he said. You know he said it because he was mad."
"I know what you're doing, and it's not going to work."
"What?"
"You still think he should have become a Kusing instead of Pwn or Vu or Sham, and you want me to smooth things over."
"Don't you feel sorry for him?" asked Dilly.
"No, not after what he said to Bowie. It was the last pebble."
Dilly rose to her feet and moved toward the door, closely followed by Sonny.
"Sleep well," she said in a pleasant voice.
"Don't you want us to check out the troops from your window?" asked Buck.
"No, you can see them tomorrow from the field."
The girls took their lights and disappeared into the hall, closing the door behind them. It was only a matter of a few silent moments before the door reopened and Dilly added her last thoughts. "I'll be back early in the morning to discuss the schedule of things. We've got 7 pages of tasks to do, and that's not counting the spots we've got to check to prepare for the Dread's future attack, so hurry and get some sleep."
Dilly was gone in a flash, leaving the room dark again. Buck and Boot climbed into their beds while Dodd took a seat by the window.
"I can't believe the Dread has Pap's books," lamented Dodd, gazing out at the hazy night sky.
"I can't believe he lost the key to Pap's place," groaned Boot. "I'd wager he's got a boatload of gear up there, the kind of stuff I've never seen before."
"Well, I can't believe Dilly uninvited us to look out her window," whined Buck. "And here we came so close. The mystery is still a mystery."
"Get used to it," responded Boot. "Girls are a mystery."
"That's true," added Dodd. "I don't have any sisters, but my aunt is always saying that a woman's first right is to change her mind as many times as she wants, and a man's first duty is to accept it."
The conversation died down and the threesome drifted off, with Dodd falling asleep last, sagging pathetically against the window pane. In the morning, everyone was busy. Dodd went begging throughout Green Hall for an hour and gathered a small wardrobe to wear, tiding him over until Pap's clothes could be reached. Buck coordinated with Sonny to produce a copy of the all-encompassing list, prioritizing and organizing as they went along. Dilly slipped out early, fraternizing with Drat forces, using her social skills to assess numbers and obtain tidbits of information. Boot went to work on establishing the exact location of Pap's place and determining an alternate entry. The next few days were similar, fast-paced and list-oriented.
A lot of the tasks weren't hard, just time-consuming. Other green Koosings and greenlings were enlisted by Boot or Dilly, privately as favors to them, to get some of the things done. They were utilized on less difficult jobs, searching for Boot's missing horse Grubber, obtaining a current list of important guests at Twistyard, examining the pots for characters of unusual behavior, visiting surrounding villages all the way from Janus Pass to Highgate in order to collect rumors, befriending the more than 600 Drat soldiers camped at Twistyard, and recounting any interesting conversations. Oddities were all reported to Dilly and added to her book of everything. In order to find the Dread, or at least determine his connection to Twistyard, Dilly insisted on investigating every plausible lead. Fortunately, with the commotion created by the arrival of the soldiers, things at Twistyard were interrupted from their regular schedules. Many of the greats were commissioned by Bombu or Commendus to attend to other responsibilities, usually undisclosed to the public, and were thus unable to hold planned training sessions. Consequently, less structured events and peer practice groups became the temporary norm. It was a perfect climate for accomplishing Dilly's agenda without appearing too suspicious. After a week, Dilly asked to hold an early morning meeting in Boot's room, despite Buck's protests that he needed his sleep in order to be competent enough to help her find trouble. As usual, Buck's complaining was useless. Dilly convinced Boot through the door to ready things so she and Sonny could enter, and then she proceeded to have Sonny read the most essential notes taken from her book of everything. Her indispensables were beyond lengthy. They went on and on, listing all sorts of facts and conjectures that had been compiled from the week's efforts, and Dilly felt the urge to interrupt and explain much of what she had written. So, by the time Sonny got to the end, someone had to reawaken Buck. A long arm over his eyes was Dilly's first clue that he wasn't paying close attention. And near the conclusion of Sonny's reading, he had begun snoring. "Buck," snapped Dilly, shaking him back to consciousness. "You need to concentrate. If we don't figure this out, who will?" "Ah, you're right," said Buck sleepily. He hadn't fully heard her question. "Wake up and listen," said Dilly. "We don't have time to go over all of this again." "Yeah," agreed Boot with a sigh. He had participated respectfully, but couldn't help noticing that it had already taken nearly 2 hours. His stomach was aching to eat breakfast, and that wasn't all. Despite having helped to accomplish so many tasks during the week, Dilly's list of things for him to do had actually grown larger than the one she had started with, because jobs were being added faster than he could complete them. It was too tiring to think about on an empty stomach. After Boot's pleading, Dilly agreed to reread only a greatly abbreviated update of the highlights. They were the ones she personally thought were critical enough to go over twice. Pap's house is unreachable from any normal passage. Shaft door is unusually secure and unbreakable. Only logical entrance is from Uke's private quarters, off the balcony, up a 20 to 30 foot wall to roof gardens, and up another undetermined wall to Pap's hidden patio. Zerny and Jib had nothing unusual in living quarters, seemed committed to soldiers, disinterested in Boot's friendship, won't divulge any information on the matter of current affairs. Miz's two sons now staying with them. Sob accepted Boot's invitation to play Belurse, triple team, pending opportunity and strat schedule. Rumors at Highgate claim Drat and Bobwitz are mounting an alliance to change the mode of government. Rumors around Lower Janus claim Treaders want to change the mode of government. Neither location can substantiate source of rumors. Both groups are agitated. Never got a chance to meet with 12 ambassadors from Sush. People say they were headed up the coastal cities. Grubber reportedly seen near Lower Janus, never found. Sirlonk introductions. Dilly met 13 dignitaries. None of them appeared overly suspicious. One of them was related to Yuke's wife, Salusi. Was wacky in the head, but not deemed dangerous. Two were ordinary at swordplay. One was overly fascinated with the Maj and acquainted with Bly and his inventions. Eight were stuffy in the hat, typical royalty. One was quiet and sickly, seemed a pest to Sirlonk, who was attempting to entertain them at Bombu's request. 17 locations checked for Dodd's suspicious vibes of a future attack from the Dread. None appeared correct. Remaining 5 spots are all heavily guarded. Need a plan to enter them. Sword Tower, Tannis Barracks, Histo Relic Building, Santo Museum Basement, Grand Hall Diplomacy Council Basement. Dodd read first volume of Pap's record from Bombu. Very detailed about each event, though no specific information about the Dread. probably written too early. One important observation at the end of the book, the Dread seems to fit in well with royalty. Should check the 13 dignitaries, assistants, and travel associates for anyone of interest. Reportedly 36 people. Sent letter to Duchy and Rall, but no response yet. Seeking more detailed reason for leaving suddenly when he quit Rall Kusings. Perhaps see if anyone heading to Rall could check in on him and hear his story in person. Had conversations with many of the greats to pry clues. Tritacello, an unsuccessful attempt was made to steal Triblots from Highgate. He said it had to be an insider, wouldn't say why. He stayed at Twistyard briefly, spent time with Ascertaining the library in Sir Lonkin's Sword Tower, and then headed toward Lower Janus. Strat, both sides of the nighttime clandestine meeting had received invitations, supposedly from the other party, hand-delivered by an unknown Drat messenger. They were confusing and suspicious. That's why Sir Lonk and Strat were slow to dismount their horses. In the end, Sir Lonk was sent into the tent to read the Drat's invitation letter, allegedly signed, "Your close friends at Twistyard." Uke, Twistyard-centered search might be a lure to keep eyes focused away from the real points of concern. He was more worried about possible corruption at Highgate, based on them possessing the only operating portal left in Green, to Rall, and from Rall to Sush. Tinja, Hatu expert martial arts, and Treep, food and poison specialist, were assigned by Bamboo to live in Sush Hall with Jim and the remaining others from Sush to protect them after a death threat was received by Bamboo, claiming the Dread would finish his work. "And that's about it," said Dilly, finishing up. Boot wondered why she couldn't have given them that version the first time, though he didn't dare say anything for fear she would drag things out and delay his breakfast. Dodd did his best to appear alert, which was a mountainous task considering how late they had been out the night before, and the frequent insomnia that plagued him personally, driven by his fears about confronting the Dread. "Everything else is small stuff," said Dilly, sounding and looking like a teacher as she finished flipping through her pages. "We need to focus our efforts on the most important things and move faster." "Most important to whom?" whined Buck, barely entering the world of the living. He was still wiping sleep from his eyes, having napped perilously through much of Sonny's reading, and having nearly dipped off again during Dilly's synopsis. "We've been chasing around here nonstop for a week," Buck continued, following a big yawn. "We've been working all day and sneaking about the halls till the middle of the night, nearly getting caught by your buddy Jib and his security pals." Buck looked at Dilly and Sonny and groaned loudly, like a third-grade nag who didn't want to practice his times tables anymore. "Can't we take a break?" he said, moaning as though in horrendous pain. He rolled onto his back, flung his hands out in both directions, and begged for freedom. It was quite a show, especially coming from Buck, who typically kept himself appropriate and complained sensibly. Dilly and Sonny stared, vaguely amused. Boot and Dodd crossed their fingers behind their backs, hoping that Buck's actions weren't summoning another lengthy lecture. "We could go fishing on Lake Modge," said Buck, dribbling on, since he appeared to have the stage. He misread Dilly's silence as a sign that he was actually making headway. "And look, it's a perfect blue sky," he added, rolling sideways to point out the window. "After all, the troops have settled down enough that they're playing games half the time. If there was an imminent threat against Twistyard or a real danger to the democracy, don't you think other people would be concerned too?" "They are," responded Dilly sharply. "Didn't you hear what we just barely read? Everyone is concerned, especially Bamboo." "Yes, I heard," said Buck glumly. "But if things are relaxed sufficient for Sir Long to take a vacation, I'm sure we could take a few moments." Buck swung into a sitting position, his eyebrows raised, and added, "Well, we really should ponder over and discuss the facts we've obtained." "While fishing?" blurted Sonny. "Okay, so you see where I'm going," said Buck in a subdued, excited way. He was partially hopeful, but mostly cognizant of the reality that Dilly would kibosh his efforts in the end. "Out on the lake, we could talk about this kind of stuff all day and nobody would hear us," said Buck, plugging in his most logical point. "That's the real reason I want to go fishing." He looked at Dilly and Sonny with his best angelic face, his big, wounded puppy blue eyes pleading, and waited for a reply. "How do you know Sir Long's taking a vacation?" snapped Dilly, redirecting the conversation to her priorities. She completely ignored Buck's request for a day off and didn't even address it with an answer. Sonny stayed silent but squirmed, feeling guilty when Buck's critter eyes did their best begging and were still rejected by her sister. "Oh, I bumped into Junie last night in the hall," said Buck defeatedly. lying back down, his arms once more across his eyes. She said they were heading off to a family gathering in Rawl. I got her to promise me that she would bring back some chew yummy from Dursich. She might even be successful if Sir Lonk doesn't eat it all en route. He's not big on sharing, you know. Dodd's mouth started to water at the thought of chew yummy. It had a flavor that tasted like the creamiest milk chocolate ever invented. And Dursich Rawl was the holy city of sweet treats, known for making the best desserts in the three worlds. Can we continue this rendezvous after breakfast, begged Boot? Apparently the mention of chew yummy was too much for his growling stomach to take. Please, hold on to your chins for a minute, insisted Dilly, positioning herself firmly between the boys and the door. If Sir Lonk and Junior headed to Rawl, they might be able to check in on Duchy. Did they say at what time they were planning on leaving? I don't remember them being specific about that, answered Buck. But I'm sure they've got to be heading out soon or they'll miss the lowering of the Triblot barrier at noon. You know how slowly Junie rides. Quick, Dilly, let's go, said Boot with a smile on his face. Why don't you and Sonny run ahead to the stalls while we go and search the Great Hall? All right, responded Dilly happily. You take the long corridor by the wall of pictures. We'll go straight. Hopefully we'll catch them in time. Dilly stowed her book of everything and, tugging at Sonny's arm, hurried toward the door. Buck and Dodd nodded at Boot, acknowledging his cunning manipulation of Dilly's morning energy. However, as though Dilly had eyes on the back of her head, she added a last request as she slipped out of the room. Don't take too long eating your breakfast, Boot. I shall be expecting you to bring us food in a flippy. We have plenty to do today, and you know how cross I get when I miss a meal. The girls disappeared with a flash of bouncing curls. Buck walked to the door and waited until they were out of hearing range to begin complaining. He muttered a few statements about Miss Princess Twisty returning to her old throne and found his canker spurred Boot to tell a gamut of jokes at their expense. But Boot wasn't genuinely huffed like Buck, who sincerely wished to spend the day fishing. On the contrary, he was caught up in the moment, having fun until the humor snowballed into a carnival-like atmosphere. Dodd, on the other hand, hardly noticed what Boot said or did as they prepared to leave for breakfast, which was really something considering Boot's repertoire included material that made Buck laugh so hard tears streamed down his cheeks, rendering him unable to tie his shoes or button his shirt. Instead, a catastrophe flooded Dodd's mind, consuming his attention with eerie images. It was an instant replay of a horrible nightmare he had already endured three times that week, a dream that wouldn't go away and had caused him to lose sleep. This time he could see a mountain of rubble, a heap of stones and support beams, and Boot's leather bag on the top. Moans and cries for help seeped through the cracks from countless voices. It was a dreary chorus of hauntingly familiar voices. To Dodd, the message was distinctly a reminder of the Dread's pending attack, and the stone pattern on the floor was definitely Twistyard. "Hey, guys," whispered Dodd ominously, breaking into their jovial fun. His eyes panned across the room and rested on Boot's bag, making the pictures in his mind all the more real. Buck and Boot noticed his apprehensive face and recognized he had serious things to say. "We need to check those other five buildings, and soon," said Dodd bracingly, knowing he was sounding like the lovely twosome who had earlier set themselves up for Boot's buoyant ridicule. "The Dread is coming. I keep seeing glimpses of the destruction he plans, and it's horrible. He wants us dead, as many as he can get here at Twistyard." "Could we do it after fishing?" asked Buck, jokingly, trying to hold back his laughter. He couldn't help it. The impersonation Boot had just done of Dilly, refusing to let them go out on the lake, was enough brotherly medicine to fix Buck's spirits for a week. "Maybe," said Dodd hesitantly, missing Buck's humor. "We will need to plan well if we are going to break into Sword Tower tonight." "Sword Tower," said Buck, sobering a little. "Do we have to begin with the most heavily guarded building?" "Probably," agreed Boot, having fully regained his composure. It was the first thing he had said in 5 minutes using his own voice instead of imitating Dilly's. "From the start," he began. But he had to stop and clear his throat before continuing. "Dilly's been saying from the start that Sword Tower was the spot, and she's usually right. But don't tell her I said it. Besides," said Boot, his tone becoming more serious, "I'm sure if the Dread wanted to damage our ability to defend ourselves, he would logically seek to destroy the sword-filled basement vaults, reportedly bigger than the field out front. Most of them haven't been touched since the destruction of Doss. I've heard there are enough swords to instantly raise a mighty Treader army if the time ever arises. We should sneak in for sure. Tonight, if possible. I'd say..." The conversation ended abruptly when it was disrupted by someone knocking on the open door. Buck and Dodd threw nervous glances. Toose rapped his knuckles and cocked his head awkwardly, sensing he had interrupted something important. He had a puzzled look on his face, while standing proper like a tin soldier. "I have a message to deliver," he started to say, when Boot seized him with a warm welcome. "Come on in, Toose," said Boot jauntingly, sounding his usual happy self. He quickly hid any indication of the more serious conversation he had just begun with Dodd and Buck. It was amazing. Boot was a masterful people person, capable of figuratively throwing a blanket over a chest of pirate's gold right under the nose of the captain and get away with concealing it for himself. One moment he was creatively directing Dilly, the next lifting his brother from depression to gleeful contentment, then discussing serious life-saving matters, and finally cleverly hiding trouble with an outer cloak of boisterous lightheartedness. His voice and mannerisms didn't miss a beat. "It's a great day to jilt the Bookards out of Rawl," said Boot, instantly snaring Toose's full attention with the mention of sports. Anything Toose had accidentally heard about Sword Tower seemed to float away, leaving him wistful-eyed. "Have you come with news from Strat on the Blurst time? We haven't played a full-out round of Blurst triple team for years. I'm ready to show them who's going to win this fall. Not to mention, I still got to determine those three empty spots. We'll be the ones to represent Twistyard this year, and you can rest assured we'll bring back the Golden SWAT." "I did speak with Strat this morning," responded Toose eagerly, glad to be impressing Boot. "He said he had a few important things he needed to attend to over the next 3 days. However, after that, he'd be willing to call a fair match and hold the unofficial Blurst battle." Toose walked into the room and made himself comfortable on Dodd's bed. His head had left him for somewhere else at the mention of Blurst. "Do you really think we'll beat Rawl this fall?" asked Toose, somewhat dazed. He blearily looked at Boot and said, "I'd love to be on a team that wins the Golden SWAT for Twistyard. If you pick me to help out, I promise I won't let you down. My great-grandpa was a real pro back in his day. I'm sure if I played on a winning team, my dad wouldn't stop bragging for years. The whole town back home would have sore ears before he'd be done." Dodd pointed to the door and said somberly, "We should probably go." Every time anyone brought up the subject of Blurst, it made Dodd sick to his stomach. Hearing Toose go on and on about it chased away his desire for breakfast. He wanted to have fun with the other guys, but he was terrified of making a complete fool of himself, of destroying the respectable image he had worked so hard to create. Regular practices were about to begin in a few short days, and Dodd knew Boot and Buck would soon come to realize that he wasn't very good at sports. According to the official rules for creating teams to compete for the position that would represent Twistyard, all 15 Koosings from Green had to play on the same team, only dipping into the Greenlings and Pots for replacing vacancies or injured persons, and of course for filling the remaining three spots to round off the team at 18 players. Rawl Koosings and Sush Koosings formed their teams the same way. After that, Lings and Pots had their chance to create teams of 18 players to compete for the same position, giving the Koosing teams practice. Yet never in the history of the game had a non-Koosing team been victorious enough to represent Twistyard in the real matches for the Golden SWAT. It seemed horribly unfair. The last thing Dodd wanted was to dash Boot's dream of winning by hexing the team with his presence, and the first thing Toose wanted was to fill a spot. Dodd kept telling himself that it might be different, that his abilities would be better, and that his skills at sports would rise to the occasion somehow. But it didn't work very well. He still felt sick. "Oh, wait, before you go," chimed Toose, his ruddy cheeks reddening with embarrassment. "I forgot to tell you, I have an important message from Dilly. She said the three of you need to hurry yourselves to the stalls. You're leaving for Highgate right now." "What?" said Buck. "She's gone for a couple of minutes and already she's decided to order the rest of our day without asking our opinions? I think Dilly is getting bossier than a full-grown bull stalled up with calves." "Actually," added Toose, "Bombu recommended you accompany Dodd to Highgate in response to a letter he received this morning from Commendus. I heard him telling Dilly right out there in the hall. She sent me here to fetch you while she and Sonny went on to get the horses saddled up." "See, Buck," chuckled Boot, "her whole family has voted to ruin your day of fishing. Let's start moving. If we hurry, we'll have time to grab something to eat. I bet Mercy would even pack us lunches." Toose begged to come along until Boot whispered in his ear. Right away, he settled down and grinned wide enough to fit three popsicles. "I'll do it," he responded happily, gliding his hand across the top of his slick hair as though it would make it flatter than it already was. His part down the center was immaculate, and he looked like a banker who had just closed a substantial deal. Down the hall, Buck and Dodd pestered Boot, wondering what he had asked of Toos that so quickly replaced his usual persistence with compliance. "I simply gave him orders to stay home and play pranks on our friends from Rawl, especially Sob," said Boot, cracking his mischievous smile. "I figure we need to get them ready. We want to have a Balur showdown like none other, and we all know we play better when they're mad at us." Dodd looked up at Boot and knew there was more to his whisper than that, but Buck didn't catch on.
"Really?" said Buck. "I'm amazed that Toos responded so promptly. You're becoming a great leader, Boot. I don't know how you do it."
Buck's sincere compliment made Boot feel guilty enough to confess the rest of the deal. "I may have also promised Toos a spot on the Balur's team with us."
"I see," muttered Buck. "It's just as well that you stop torturing poor Toos. He's the best greenling at Balur's, and yet you've had him guessing all this time whether or not you would let him play with us on the field this year. I can't believe it."
"Or actually," said Buck, pausing to size Boot up, "since I'm your brother, it's sad to say, but I can."
When the boys arrived at the kitchen, Mercy was waiting, holding an overflowing satchel of food. She appeared annoyed and excited at the same time. Her head shook back and forth, working on a good scold, before Boot even got close enough to reach for the fare.
"You're way too slow," she chided, poking at the boys in a grandmotherly way. She was strangely stern and kind.
"You'll miss the noon drop at Highgate if you don't quicken your little steps. Dilly said you'd be coming at an expeditious pace, but if that's what you're doing, don't be entering any races. I've seen newborn pups move faster with their eyes still shut."
"We have plenty of time to ride and make it long before the shield comes down," responded Boot, giving Mercy a sideways squeeze with one arm while reaching for the food with the other. Mercy held on to the bag.
"I don't know, boys," she said.
"Of course you don't. You wouldn't," suggested Boot hastily. He waited for Mercy to look up at him, horrified by his statement, before he continued on, smirking.
"You wouldn't know because you haven't been on a horse in company with Dilly lately. Song never walks or trots. That horse has one speed. Fast. We'll be lucky if we don't eat our horses tonight after their misfortunate retirement, given the quick pace of Dilly's stallion. Though Grubber could keep up if only he'd first show up."
"Yes, that's awful about your horse," said Mercy, changing the subject. She spoke quickly as though it made up for continuing to keep the boys captive with her jabbering, all the while maintaining a relentless grip on the food. "You've had him for many years, haven't you, Boot? Higa said people spotted him in Lower Janus earlier this week, tethered in a field on the outskirts. He'll probably turn up soon."
"They usually do. Grubber's got a look that stands out. Whoever stole him will likely not appreciate the attention he attracts. They'll have to leave him behind or get caught."
"And speaking of nice looking," continued Mercy, grabbing Dodd's arm, "you sure shined up today. Have you got enough clothes and such? If you need anything, I'd love to help you."
"Bamboo requested I attend to it. He trusts my taste, you know. Why, there was the time that..."
Mercy babbled on and on, talking rapidly, ever clinging to the bag of provisions. It was ironic that she had tormented the boys with how they were destined to be late, yet wouldn't release them from her verbal grip. It was typical of Mercy. Finally, after 5 minutes of nodding and agreeing, and fearing Dilly's wrath, Boot carefully grabbed for the satchel, right in the middle of a sentence.
"Manners, boy," snapped Mercy firmly. "Always remember your manners."
But the rebuke was quickly followed by warm wishes and hugs, and another admonition to be off in a rush. The boys made tracks down the corridor through the great hall and out into the front field. On the way, Dodd asked how long they would be staying at Highgate. He had noticed that nobody seemed interested in bringing any personal belongings or changes of clothing, despite the fact that the tri-blot barrier was only lifted once a day.
"I would imagine just a couple of nights," responded Boot. "We have to be back before Strat holds the Balur's challenge. I wouldn't miss it for anything, including being pampered by Commendus."
"And we don't need any luggage?" asked Dodd carefully. He had a hard time openly saying that he preferred having pajamas to sleep in and a fresh outfit each morning. After all, he had spent the first few days wearing the same thing, so it would sound hypocritical to start getting picky. Not to mention, he had even worn his shoes to bed in front of them. But that was a safety measure while adjusting to the new world filled with surprises, like Venus attacks in the middle of the night.
"When you're personally invited by Commendus, there's no need to pack," assured Boot. "He takes pride in giving his guests the best of everything, down to the clothing he provides. You can't say no to him either. If you were to show up with a suitcase, it would likely offend him."
At the barn entrance, Dilly and Sonny were waiting with horses, saddled and ready to ride. You could loan Dilly his two horses for Boot and Dodd to use. He had even helped get them ready, saying that Junie and Sir Lonk had left an hour before, so if Dilly hoped to catch up, she would need to hurry. Dilly gave orders, as always, and insisted they follow Uke's advice. They would race until they reached Junie and Sir Lonk, and then they would slow down and enjoy the remaining stint to Highgate. She even added as a motivating tool that no one could eat the food Mercy had packed until they joined their friends. And to better enforce her rule, she snatched the satchel from Boot and tied it to the back of Dodd's horse. Having stated her plan, she took Comendus's invitation from her front pocket and tucked it away safely inside her book of everything, telling Dodd he was lucky to have been invited to a private meeting with Comendus. However, Dodd didn't feel so lucky. He hadn't been given a chance to see the fancy note addressed to him that Dilly brooded over. And when the others mounted their horses to ride, Dodd didn't want to make a fuss, but his seemed ornery the moment he sat down. And worse still, once Dilly nudged Song into a quick trot, Dodd struggled to keep up. At first he thought it was just his poor riding skills, but he was wrong. And by the time everyone discovered the truth, it was already a complete disaster.